Well, uselessness is a difficult thing. That's different for each person. Everybody has a different category of what's useful and what's useless.
現実の世界が少しずつあなたが描いた未来に近づいてきたっていうイメージをすごくしているんですけれども、あなたの頭の中にはもうすでにその先の未来が描かれているんですか？
Well, I've been painting the future for a long time, like 50 or 60 years. And what I always try to do is to make it relate to human beings. I always put people in my pictures. Because here's the thing. If you're going to show a very strange future, you have to have some recognizability trigger. So you look at the picture and you think, oh, well, there's people there. They're having a good time. Must be okay.
Welcome to this year's convention. I'm Ridley Scott. I've just completed production on my latest picture since Alien. Blade Runner, starring Harrison Ford as the classic hardboiled detective, is based on Philip Dick's novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? We've prepared a special short film for you on the making of the picture, including the wizardry of Douglas Trumbull and the imaginative industrial designs of Sid Mead that helped us create this view of tomorrow.
You start with a recognizable parking meter inside all this stuff. When you no longer can accept coins or metal discs or whatever, you add a electronic register that accepts a magnetic card. The post mechanical case becomes electrified, but if you touch it or try to attack it, you're electrocuted, which is a very brutal attack on you as a human.
2001,
A Space Odyssey.
I'm Wes.
I'm Brad.
A fabulous bird, reborn from the ashes of its earlier life.
Max, how do you say chicken?
Corizon.
Thank you. You are cleared through voice print identification.
Yes, I agree.
Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal.
Oh my God, it's full of stars. 2010, here we make contact.
So Sid Mead was born in St. Paul, Minnesota. Born in 1933, you know, he just passed away at the end of 2019. I remember that day.
My father was a Baptist minister, and for some unknown reason, he read Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers to me before I learned to read. I have no idea why, still don't. So the car fascination took over rocket ships. And my first car drawing that I have, I did when I was 3 years old. When you're a child, you're looking up at everything. So the car has, you know, a lot of body and very small windows, sort of like now. So I was 70 some years ahead of the market. And there's people waving out the window of the car. So it was a scenario thing from the start. I learned to draw, and I learned to draw better and better and better, because if you're visualizing your ideas, mm-hmm. and I had a propensity for fantasy, then the better you can render your idea, the more real it becomes as a fantasy extension of your imagination. And I think that's what drove me to keep trying and refining technique, and I had a lot of time. Nowadays, kids, you know, you have dance class, the kids go to writing class, they want them to be a lawyer, doctor, whatever, politician, and they're pummeled into this constant 24-hour push to be something. And they end up, you know, 35 and married, and they still don't know who they are. I knew who I was very early on, and drawing was part of it. And I spent hours and hours and hours drawing. So obviously, the more you do something, if you do it reasonably right, you get better at it.
He was recruited to Ford Motor Company in 1959. He went on to work for United States Steel, Philips Electronics, Sony, you know, Minolta, Honda, a bunch of companies. Bandai, he was hired to illustrate books and catalogs. And industrial design, that was his specialty as a draftsperson, and concept. So you think about it, like, hired by Ford in 1959. Mm-hmm. Rob Vacher, if you're listening, have you ever wondered if Sid Mead did any of the designs for the Ford Skyway of the future?
Oh, no way.
For the 64 World's Fair? Because he would have been there at the time. He would have been employed.
The U.S. Steel books went horizontal. That was the first big visibility boost. That actually started my career, because a career depends on referrals and a visibility that generates demand for having you do something for somebody and get paid for it. By the time I worked in the movie industry, by invitation, I'd been working for corporations and for 20 years doing illustrations and design work. So the movie was just another business flowing through my corporation. I didn't really attach any particular importance to it, other than that, do your best,
sure.
get briefed on what you're supposed to be doing in the first place, and then go ahead and do it.
But one of the most impressive illustrations, when I was growing up looking at these things that you'd done, was the illustration of the traffic jam in New York at night with the sentinels and
in the rain, and it's
right. dark, yeah. and that to me had that feel of Blade Runner, and that has to be something that you did 5, 6, 7, 8 years before Blade Runner,
Hell
right?
Yes. I did that in the 60s.
Whoa!
Wow.
And that rendering was what Ridley liked a lot, because you saw there was no horizon.
Right.
It's architecture. It's dreary. The rain is. It's horrible weather, and it's futuristic.
In the Cinefex article, Sid, about Blade Runner, they quote you as saying that when you design automobiles, you cannot just put a blank automobile on a page. It has to be in a lived-in scene. And I was noticing in that book that you have the backgrounds and so forth. And that would seem to imply that beyond the frame of that, or beyond the car, you have got ideas for an entire civilization, a whole society in which that car and those people and those buildings and everything else operate. Do you?
That approach is a carryover, I suppose, of the way I was trained to design and think regarding real cars. Because if you're going to design for a consumer market, you have to visualize the society that's going to use them, where they're going to be driven. Cars are lower today because we have paved roads, for instance.
Starting with Blade Runner, he was credited as visual futurist, and that's certainly what he was. Among many things, that was what he's most known for.
In other words, we are rapidly approaching our limits as far as how small we can make things. Electronic things.
Not really.
No?
They're working on a protein computer. If they're successful, and what they're trying to do is grow protein molecules in ordered paths.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're down at the molecular level, which is magnitudes of density greater in terms of memory storage. If they're successful, you could theoretically store the entire recorded history of mankind in a 1 centimeter square cube.
It's happening very, very fast. Ray Kurzweil came to our house. He was on the front end of making his movie called The Singularity. And his contention is that the speed up is speeding up. So it increases the proportion every jump. And eventually the singularity in data, graphical data depiction, is when everything goes, all the asymptotes, which are the data segments, go parallel vertical, and it goes asymptotic, and you can't graph the progress anymore. So he says that'll happen about 2035 or something like that, which is not that far away.
Well, I've been astonished when, in terms of autonomous technology, the great leap forward we've seen in only 6 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, and I credit
so the
DARPA
next three.
Challenge.
We're going to see even more in the next three. Will for sure.
Well, technology. If you solve three problems, the next stage you solve seven, and then because it builds on itself, it's logarithmic. And the robot industry, humanoid anthropomorphic robots, are getting very, very accomplished. And the first target is to help old people like me go up and down stairs or carry stuff. And they'll be in medical facilities and old age or retirement, let's call them retirement, silver lodges. That's what they're, I think the guy from Honda said in 20 years we'll be making robots, not cars.
That's it, sir. I can't do any better.
Aye, lad.
It's borderline on the simulator, Captain. I cannot guarantee that she'll hold up.
Warp drive, Mr. Scott.
Ahead, warp one, Mr. Sulu.
Accelerating to warp one, sir.
So John Dykstra and his partner Bob Shepard had a company called Apogee. They were assigned by Robert Wise, the director, to do post-production for Star Trek The Motion Picture, the first of the Star Trek series. And I got a phone call. I'd just moved out here in 75, so this is now 78. Get a phone call from Bob Shepard, and would you like to meet for lunch and work on a science fiction film? And I thought, well, that's nice, you know. I had no particular ambition to be in the film industry at all. I'd been doing corporate design work for 20 years before that. So I had lunch with them at the Century Plaza Hotel and started doing the designs for V'ger at the end of the climax of the film. Met Robert Wise.
Let's check out this stretch. 1979. Start is this the beginning of his career as credited as a production illustrator, hired for Star Trek The Motion Picture.
V'ger.
1982, hired by Ridley for Blade Runner. Working with Douglas Trumbull as a visual futurist.
Crazy.
A new life awaits you in the off-world colonies. The chance to begin again in a golden land of opportunity and...
And the overall idea to start with was a society where technology, life had become very difficult, and the mechanical fixtures, automobiles, trucks, buildings, the whole urban plant had become like a trap for people in the society. So I started off with very clean, designed concepts, and then successively layered on top of those initial ideas sort of an accumulation of detail, repairs, and extra pieces of equipment that weren't the original equipment idea, and achieve this accumulated fix it because it won't run or has to run visual flavor, which is the whole essence of the film. So it isn't a new, shiny, futuristic society. It's a society where the normal supplies have broken down. The street level particularly had become like the sewers or the underside of the city, and being trapped on the street was not only just unromantic, but a thoroughly nasty way to spend your life, because the street was simply a service access to the mega structures and the high-rises that now comprise the city. Decent people really didn't live below 40 stories above the street. So then you start to get this accretion or an accumulation of detail, which are generators, vent pipes, a whole leftover kind of society that you're forced to live with, because that's all there is. You can't afford to go up. And it takes a trend that is happening in some of the larger urban centers and accelerates it and caricatures it, makes it more brutal and more glamorous at each end of the scale than it is now.
Same year, Tron, concept artist for the electronic world.
I received a call from Steve Lisberger, who was the director of Tron, and met him for lunch on the Disney lot to discuss this film to be called Tron. I first started doing all the vehicles for the film, again doing the hardware, and found out that we're all going to be generated on the computer. So we had a vehicle set which consisted of the tank, the light cycles, which were the feature vehicles because they were used in the high-speed race chase sequences, Sark's aircraft carrier, and a startup on the Solar Sailor, which was eventually done by Mobius.
Then 84-2010, again, visual futurist. So Peter gives him rightfully the same title as Ridley. Then Aliens, right after that, in 86. So he goes straight from Blade Runner and Tron to 2010, and straight from 2010 to Aliens. So he designs the Sulaco right after he designs the Leonov.
Jeez.
Sid Mead, who's truly a visionary, and he was able to imagine things that might not necessarily ever work, but looked bitchin'.
Jim Cameron FedExed the script down to me, stayed up all night reading it. He's a great writer, and came back on the plane sketching this Sulaco, and it was a ball. It's in one of our books. And I showed it to him. He said, no, we can't. This has to go by the camera. We don't want to pull focus. It has to be a slab kind of a thing. So that's why the shape ended up as it did.
He's a concept artist, credited as a concept artist there. He's got some other things like Time Cop, working with Peter Hyams in some other movies. But then in 1994, Yamato 2520. You ever heard of that anime?
Is it about a battleship? That sounds kind of familiar.
Because in 1997, apparently he worked on this game, this classic game, Wing Commander Prophecy.
Commander was a big PC series for a while.
He apparently designed the aliens for that.
That's cool.
But then, remember how I said he did some work for Bandai?
Mm-hmm.
In 1999, Turn a Gundam, he was a concept designer for. Do you know that one?
What?
Which Gundam is that? Turn a Gundam, 1999 to 2000.
That would be Gundam Seed,
okay.
I believe. I think.
Turn a Gundam.
Yeah, Nishizaki, his company called me. They flew me over there, met me at Narita. Nishizaki was a member of the family. He was sort of considered sort of the bad boy of that family. But he was very successful. He's a very rich bad boy. And so he picked me up in this Ford van with television screens and telephones and everything inside of it, and a bar, the whole. I had sake on the way from Narita into Tokyo. And that back then I could take a trans-Pacific flight, smoke, get off the plane, have drinks. You know, you're younger and more resilient. So anyway, then I met Matsumoto-san, who designed the first generation of Yamato. And I thought, you know what this is? This is a space, kind of a submarine battleship combination. But the first design that Matsumoto did didn't have sort of a bottom to it that violated being sort of a land thing. So it was very close to the original Yamato destroyed battleship, but only for space. So I made it more three-dimensional, had the lower mast, the high mast, and I wanted it to look like sort of a huge ninja ship with the big flaring, trailing layers and stuff.
I believe Wing was 97.
Okay.
And shortly after, they just had a film. That's absolutely insane.
So guess what his next movie credit is? Mission to Mars for Brian De Palma.
I always enjoyed that film. Too. I know a lot of people didn't necessarily like it, but
it has its...
It's got its moments. But
it's beautiful, though. There's so much beautiful stuff in it.
And just let people kind of enjoy it. I can hear Neil deGrasse Tyson right now tearing that movie absolutely apart.
Brian De Palma, in every movie, always does one thing with the camera that nobody's done before. And in Mission to Mars, he does the most incredible from far away outside the capsule, slowly going in through the window and then going up and then down, following the anti-gravity space station 5 or Orion style.
Yeah.
It's what I call a hardware film, meaning that everything that you show has to be constructed, built, or visualized in some way, because once you leave Earth, which represents about the first 5 minutes of the film, everything else is created. So those are the biggest challenges that we have at first, is pre-visualization of what this film might look like.
De Palma is going for legitimate look. Sid Mead is the person who can always think new, think real, and invent real stuff that we could actually potentially use in the future. And even though he didn't work on 2001, he's got the exact same mindset as the concept designers of 2001.
Yeah, nothing fantastical about his vision. This is just extrapolated from the technology we currently have.
Except... then he goes on to do Elysium as a concept artist.
Really?
Which is pretty out there. And also Tomorrowland.
Okay.
Which is an underrated film, I think.
Wait, Tomorrowland.
That's the George Clooney Brad Bird movie.
I have not seen that.
Credited as a visual futurist on that one.
I did check out Elysium. I thought that was going to be... visually, it's incredible. Like, it really is. Man, I really wanted some more, like... I don't know.
You're rooting for it to be more than
I really wanted it to be. Just, I don't know, a little more. Almost.
Sometimes there's just not enough air in the tires. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then he wraps up his career in 2017 with Blade Runner 2049.
Which was a really nice,
masterful send-off.
Send-off, exactly. I was scared to death about that coming out. No, they treated it with the respect that I... think it deserved.
I was disappointed at first when really passed the baton over. Thank God it was to Villeneuve. Great. I mean, modern art. Dune, of course, is out in theaters and going gangbusters, doing better than the first one.
Yeah.
And true cinematic artist, true sci-fi artist of the age right now. So I'm glad that that's who he trusted with it. And if he hadn't been able to do that with the window of time that he had greenlit for Covenant before Fox was sold, and thank God he took that opportunity. We wouldn't have that movie, which we both think a lot of.
Yeah.
One of the big challenges of the movie was to recreate another city. What Las Vegas would look like in 2049. And for that, there was just only one man that could give me the answer. I went back to the original creator of Blade Runner, the main dreamer of the architect of Blade Runner. I went back to Sid Mead.
So it starts with sketches like this.
We had different designs, but we felt like if we brought Sid in, we would get some of that old Blade Runner magic.
I think Las Vegas will still be there. It'll be probably larger because people like drama, they like vista, sensation. We still go to the pyramids. You can't duplicate that kind of aura unless you're actually there. I'm designing theoretical buildings, architecture. It's a sensation of vista and sort of architectural over-the-top accumulation.
He brought back those insanely beautiful views of Las Vegas that I'm very proud of. Honestly, no matter what people think about the movie, I know that the Las Vegas we did is a Blade Runner Las Vegas. I'm very happy about that. When you are far away from Los Angeles, the smog and the atmosphere is less dense, so there's much more sunlight. I'm not talking about beautiful sun, I'm talking about bleak, dark, gray days, but still a bit more than when you are deep in Los Angeles.
This is the end result of a tremendous amount of work in the art department to make an interior set for our Las Vegas casino.
Sid Mead is an exception. He's a well-known designer of everything from amusement parks to luxury yachts. But he's probably best known for his vision of L.A. in the year 2017. In the last decade, Sid Mead has become a household name in the world of science fiction movies.
How big a chunk is this man's work just part of all of collective sci-fi?
Sci-fi.
Everything that's been done is since is derivative of his.
Exactly. Like, he set the gold standard, and like you said, everything derives from that wonderful archetype that he's created.
What you can't do any better, what you can't improve on, is that kind of detail.
Yeah. It looks practical. It looks... I don't know. It's something that you could easily find yourself in and not be completely baffled and alienated by it.
No, you instantly have a perspective. You know where the point of view is. You know the relationship, the space between everything. You know the size. You know the scale.
You could take a screwdriver to it, you know?
In fact, what I'm staring at right now is a lot of screws.
Yeah.
With a lot of little slits. These are all flathead.
Oh, that's
There's
horrible.
No Phillips in here.
Now, for the long haul, flathead is a little more reliable and can last longer, but boy, do I hate them.
Slipping right in and out.
Oof, that's a good way to cut a finger. And
yeah, yeah. That's one of the things that caused the electrical fire on Christmas.
Oh, my God.
Which hopefully they're kind of fixing.
That, I believe that was a self-tapping screw.
Oh, yeah.
We were not allowed to use those, but yeah, we did anyway.
No. It was for our Christmas party. I was trying to set up the self-screwing tap.
Well, we put the magnets up there, but every time that they ran the electrical grid in reverse, they fell off and woke us up in the middle of the night. So.
And woke up the dog, and then the rest is history.
I'm surprised we didn't get kicked off.
I can't say that I'm 100% certain they're going to let us back in. All they have to do is change the locks.
Oh, no. The airlocks.
There's a lot of people taken care of today. They're product designers, transportation designers, and I admire them very much, but I think I have more fun, certainly, inventing things that may happen. And when I do go into the actual design for real-world loop, working with engineers and material specialists and the client's design staff, that works just as well.
Mead is blessed with rare talent and imagination for depicting a vision far different from our usual idea of the future. Some call it ultra-future.
Who was it that was talking? It might have been Adam Savage. It might have been Tom Spina. It's probably Tom Spina and Ken Ralston, actually, talking about the wear that you have to put on props, screen-used props, how 3-4 times the amount of wear is actually on the prop when you see it in the archive.
That's interesting to me. Can you explain how, like, the lens would eliminate some of those finer details?
Yeah, so much that's picked up in the image. When we look at a film, we got to remember that we're looking with our eyeballs through a simulated eyeball. And just like the focus mirrors our own eye focus, so do details. And so one of the things that happens is the camera picks up detail on skin, which requires makeup for people that don't need makeup in real life. And it's not vanity. It's because what you're seeing is shapes on textures. With our own eyes, we're focusing onto each other's faces and onto each other's eyes. But when we're looking at a screen, we're looking at what a camera has registered flat, different shapes and colors relative to each other. And so it's like we have to re-see everything on the screen. So you always got to put 3-4 levels of detail onto the surface of props and sets. And so what Ridley always talked about was putting in that Z-level finish. The Z-finish was like the final pass, which is that little bit of distressing, which he would often probably still does go around and do himself, dappling a little bit here, throw a little mud or some sand.
Break something off. Something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That little bit of thing, which you won't notice, but you'll feel it, because you would see it with your own eye, but you're subconsciously seeing that detail that you're not able to pick up, but the camera is doing it for you.
Wow. That is a really interesting thing that filmmakers have to deal with, because especially with the advent of these incredibly high resolution cameras.
Yeah. And high resolution scans of some of these biblical epics in 4K. And some of these things from the early 50s, you look plastic, you can almost see the tags on these things because they weren't distressed enough to hold up to that resolution. They look brand new.
Yeah, on a vacuum tube television.
it looks fine for 50 years.
It's great. You don't see the wires or anything.
And conversely, Well, you have two sides of that. What we talked about a few weeks ago with our look at Doug Trumbull and his work at accelerated frame rates and the experiment of The Hobbit and why things look fake, because they had that level of Z finish for 24 frames a second, mm-hmm. but at 48 and the higher lighting, you got to distress it that much more to not look new and fake again. Conversely, back to Blade Runner, the masters of matte painting, Albert Whitlock and Matthew Jurasich, and with Star Wars, Harrison Ellenshaw, the masters at being able to visualize in their head focal length and distance, because the death of a matte painting is always when it's too detailed in the background. That's when you know it's a painting.
You can see it's fade off naturally. Yeah, contrast to the foreground for sure.
And it's thrilling because, and it's seductive, because you design something and it goes into production. You see the trailers or the finished footage, and they dial in sound. So this aluminum or plywood foam core board door slams shut, and it weighs 15 tons on screen.
And sounds like it.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's very, very amazing. Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Something extraordinary is going to happen. I don't know what, but we have to initiate an escape launch in 2 days.
You have been drinking your whiskey from Kentucky.
Oh, I wish I had.
Sid Mead brought his unique design talents to 2010.
The hardware, the interior of the Leonov, the general technical look, very much the complex in space, minimal cost for the maximum utilitarian value. If I had to describe in one word the look of the hardware that I designed for 2010, it would be the word functional.
Production designer Albert Brenner worked with Mead to combine form and function in the visuals of the film.
It's literally designed by engineers, not by designers, interior designers. Wherever you can find a space to put a bunk and a person in, that's where you'll put them. So what we're doing is basing everything we do on known research today. What we're doing today and what the research tells us is probable tomorrow.
Uh-oh. What?
Took this out of the collection. This is a prized possession I've had for many years. Picked this up visiting our friend Ty in Arkansas at a local bookstore. Please support your local bookstores.
Sheesh, people, we're looking at the official art of 2010. Before the cameras could roll, visual futurist Sid Mead designed the mechanical wonders that became the world of 2010. I bet this is fantastic. Oh my God. Speaking of Sid Mead.
Yes. I've been saving it just for this. And since we started this podcast, I've been waiting for 2010 year and waiting for this day right now, all these years to do an episode on this.
In this dedication, Peter's wonderful vision, Frank, the greatest Leo ever, Elliot's whatever needs to be done will be, and Judy for her eternal support.
Aww.
That's
from all accounts, Sid Mead was a real sweetheart of a man as well as a great artist.
Okay, I want to see some of the juicy bits here.
So let's look at our own ship that we're...
Yeah, chapter one, the Leonov. Here we are.
We know you are building the Discovery, too. To go back to Jupiter. To find out what happened to your men up there. Also to examine the large monolith. You know that we are building the Alexei Leonov to also go up there.
I thought you were going to call it the Titov.
Yeah, we changed last month. People fall out of favor.
So this looks like charcoal almost.
I think you're right. I think it is charcoal. If you're following along at home, by the chance that you have this book, it's on page, what is that, page 12?
It's a lucky page number 13.
Uh-huh.
Wow. It's these are almost schematic-like. Absolutely amazing. Yeah, and it looks like it included some extra booms that I don't think we saw in the thematic version with these extra micro radar dishes. I don't know. I don't remember.
Maybe the camera angles, but yeah.
But the main bulk of the ship, yes, is, and it very much is kind of an evolution of the Discovery. In a lot of ways, this is a space train kind of utilitarian cargo ship for intersolar travel.
So Sid's first pass at the Leonov, the long section would have been the bridge, says Himes had several problems with this version. Most importantly, it would make the docking sequence of Discovery look awkward. If anybody out there is a fan of Dizzy Gillespie, the trumpeter has a special horn where the horn curls around by the valves where your hand is holding it, you know, and then the bell either goes straight on a regular trumpet, or in the case of this thing, goes whoop up, like cocked at a 45-degree angle up. So if you turn that over upside down, that's basically what this first version of Leonoff looks like. It's a metal trumpet with a cocked horn bell. How do I say that and not have an E on the description? What else does that look like to you, this first pass?
So it looks very much like a weapon of some sort.
I thought so too. Especially when you look at the schematic down here at the bottom that you were referencing. Because it looks like two lightsaber hilts, one going horizontal and another one below it tilting up at a 45-degree angle to join it.
That's what made me think of that Rolls Royce, because Obi-Wan's beam emitter also came from that jet engine, I'm pretty sure.
The next pass put the docking ring on the bottom and compacted the ship together. The two prongs in front were for the heat shield. Think about that.
Whoa.
That looks a little less awkward and a lot cooler, I think.
It's personally a lot cooler. It's still got a lot going on.
So then at the bottom, we have the final version. Note the complete lack of windows except in the nose. This helped create the claustrophobic feeling of modern space travel.
Wow.
Certainly in the 80s, when this is, what, 3 years, 4 years into the shuttle program?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting to think about, because they were also doing pretty regular video cast of spacewalks, and public was seeing a lot more. They were seeing a lot more, but they were caring a lot less too, which is also
one of those ironies of our existence.
We have a complete, thanks to the, there's an orbiter around the moon that takes top-down images. And it also takes hard angled telemetry and photographs. It's one of the ones that mapped the entire lunar surface. And then basically that's how they built a lot of the Google Earth models and 3D images and all that stuff is from real orbiter data, which is pretty crazy.
That is crazy.
It's called like the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've heard of that.
And in the special effects, a new realism was being sought. The work began with building the models for the spaceships. First, the old Discovery, the spaceship in 2001. This was the ship that was finally abandoned near Jupiter at the end of that film.
What is like that?
Oh, that's got to go a lot more.
Going in?
Or?
Yeah, it's a whole way.
This is the Russian ship, the Leonov, that in the new film is sent out to find the derelict Discovery.
Whoa. Okay, so this is meant to attach. We're looking at like a, it looks like an old claw machine. And it's one that you do not want to feed your quarters into, because it doesn't look like it's going to be successful.
Way too broad of a grip.
It looks like it's docked onto like a hangar.
Yeah.
Or like some kind of, maybe an orbital base. Maybe it's fueling up. I'm not sure.
I bet it docks on and clips, because it looks like a gutter brace to me.
Yeah.
And that comes from shopping for those several times in life.
Fantastic.
But also shopping for and finding specifically in a metal warehouse an industrial strength brace, macaroni shaped like that.
Okay.
That screws into a frontal plate that you can attach to your mount, because that's like it's a camera mount. It's a shoulder mount. It's 100% camera mounted. Well, there's the handle for the grip. There's the camera going that way, and there's, you put your shoulder under that little thing.
That's amazing.
At least that's what I think of it firsthand. And also, if you look at version one of the Leonov, the crazy bent firehorn bell part
the kind of looks like an eyepiece, doesn't it?
It looks like a It also looks like a grip, like a handle piece coming down.
Yeah, there may be a little bit of visual kit bashing.
Because check out the Sulaco from Aliens. Because the Sulaco looks very much like a very slender, like a big stacked machine gun, basically.
I actually received from him a sketch that he had done of his idea for the Sulaco, and that sort of steered the design to the one that I came up with, which was about an 800-foot-long, 900-foot-long armed cargo carrier, a rocket gun that carries stuff. That was sort of the theoretical concept underlay for the whole design. And the technology was not that exotic. It's not Star Trek. It's a very real-world, industrial-looking piece of stuff. So both the exterior and the interior had sort of accretions of lumps and equipment and surface detail, panelization, and so forth. The dropship compartment was at the bottom, so it could drop out and then deorbit down to the surface. So that was all very logical, very scaled to the size I was working on, and this progressed all the way through the whole design concept.
When you watch Aliens, the way they're strapped into that drop ship.
I love the dude that's literally sleeping.
Yeah, exactly.
On my mark. Five.
We're on express elevator to hell. Going down.
Two. One. Mark.
It's like the same setup that they have at the very end when they're blasting away from Jupiter.
Yeah.
That just full shaking, rocking on the gimbal motion.
Yeah.
And they're strapped in harness to this.
I wonder if that's if they're having to move themselves, you know, or if that's a a platform that they can move on, like a moving stage or something.
Well, let's see, because was that on the gimbal? Yeah, okay. The metal structure is a rotating gimbal on the set, enabling the Leonov bridge to rotate.
Okay.
So it's on a gimbal.
Cool.
Nice.
Very cool.
They had heat mixers under their seats on. Was that Star Trek?
Apparently Star Trek is all done. It's at camera shake and acting. And apparently the TNG crew came out to give lessons, getting basically direct hits on the bridge. So they'd show up to Voyager and do little demonstrations.
Gotta go to Star Trek school and learn how to...
Yeah, yeah.
Time to impact.
20 seconds.
Mr. Chekhov, stand by our phasers. No! Delay that phaser order!
Dude, this is...
What in the world? How many boosters does this thing have?
Yeah, it looks like the Falcon Heavy from the lot. It's got 78 boosters.
I mean, really?
There's a lot.
That is a lot of power. It's encouraging, though. It makes me feel like we maybe won't have to sit in this cupboard quite as long.
What's
maybe
also interesting is this midsection here looks like RTG, like a radioisotope engine. The way that these fan out look like heat dissipators, because they wouldn't have any need for solar, you know, going past. It's just so inefficient at that point. You've got to have some kind of alternate source. So I imagine there was a combustible fuel source, because they talk about how they only have enough basically for there and back as mm-hmm. far as propulsion. So not enough to slow down and take more time to, you know, investigate the crashed probe. So that makes me think, for all life support and probably any kind of electrical power they would need, it would come from the RTG. Mm. And then they would have a chemical propellant for the ship itself.
So we're not talking nuclear propulsion on this one.
I can't believe we almost had one of those. And you know that ship would have hauled ass. I mean, the poor test pilot on that one would have been out of her solar system, yes. probably, and no way of coming back.
Even that crash test dummy is on the ride of his life.
This also could have been the signal. You know, we could have had a true monolith moment.
Us just, if there was any time for
violently it, releasing nuclear it. Explosions throughout the solar system, yeah, that would have gotten the attention of somebody for sure if they were listening. So that could have been cool. That project, it sounded phenomenal. They were literally just going to drop atomic bombs out of the back of the ship and ride the explosion.
And play a Major Kong.
Hey, what about Major Kong?
Wow. I wonder why we didn't do that.
Yeah, really funny about that. Blast off!
Shorts.
Oh, okay. The Chinese ship was eliminated from the movie for two dramatic reasons, because they reference the Chinese team, and we get that very dramatic calm from the only survivor from the wrecked Chinese craft. And it says, the ship was eliminated from the movie for two dramatic reasons. Himes felt space was getting too congested. I could see that. I mean, you've already got the Discovery and the Leonov. If you add a third ship, I mean,
it's adding a third party dramatically. Yeah, you'd have
pretty hard.
So. Yeah, it's a lot harder when you're trying to visually establish. You got two really like iconic looks here between the Discovery and the Leonov.
You also thought it add a little bit of more mystery by, you know, not knowing what was down on Europa, so not having that team come back from Europa after they collected all that data.
That is amazing.
I mean, this one's definitely Sid's, but I don't know if this is his caption or not, but it says several ideas were toyed with for the error breaking sequence. Error breaking. Clark put in the novel about a heat shield that could be tucked away and folds out.
Ah, I wonder if he got that from Skylab, since he quoted.
Because they Dimitri had to take care of that airlock. Skylab. Yeah. Absolutely. Oh, you know, yeah. And I wonder if that was a big inside joke about them having to deploy an umbrella, essentially.
As a matter of fact, the whole Skylab series of flights would have been a failure had it not been for the ability of the first crew to repair the space station.
Okay, Pete, we had a little dropout.
Pete and I went down into the workshop, installed the canister that contained the parasol in the scientific airlock. Joe was observing the deployment of the parasol from the command module.
Roger, copy.
We had no trouble. I couldn't see the airlock itself, but I could see this funny-looking orange thing, all rolled up and skinny, come pooching out of there. And then Pete said, okay, we're going to let her go. And it just started to unfold and did a lot of flapping, and it kind of settled halfway folded and halfway unfolded. We deployed it as best we could, pulled it back down to it was about a foot off, and that was it. It worked quite well for the rest of the mission.
Getting back to air braking, check this out.
Wow.
So
this
it folds.
Gives me kind of like an insectoid
mm-hmm.
kind of feeling, almost like a cicada or a grasshopper, or, you know, in flight. The thorax and mm-hmm. the wings and everything.
Yeah, and it's a great buffer because, yeah, the exoskeleton look, the ridges, it looks tough. It looks like it's layered for insulation. Ultimately, after consulting with JPL and Boeing people, Hyams learned that the newest designs for air braking did not involve a heat shield. The shields are too weighty and take up too much room. Thus was born the balut,
We don't have enough fuel to slow ourselves down, so we are about to use a technique called aerobraking. The theory is we will enter the outer layer of Jupiter's atmosphere using what is called a balut for a shield. The atmosphere will slow us down, and Jupiter's gravity will grab hold of us and slingshot us around behind the dark side.
I would...
B-L-L-U-T-E.
I've never come across that.
An inflatable heat-resistant shield. Oh, so it's like a balloon parachute. An inflatable heat-resistant shield. A balut.
Balloon, mein Herr.
The ship turns off, the balut opens up, as we see in the air braking sequence, and Richard Edel does a great job with it, and the engines die. Oh, and as the engines idle, the heat is deflected around the vessel. So the antennas fold down to avoid roasting. See, I was just thinking, like, your car antenna folds down so that it didn't get caught in the car wash.
Yeah.
But in this case, it wasn't because it might snap off in the speed and the jerking of the air braking. I mean, that might have something to do with it, too. But it also folds down. So
they don't have a fault with the A35 unit, right?
Exactly. Have to go out and replace it.
Discovery has been partially revived. We don't know how much damage has been done or if we'll be able to bring it back home. Most of that is up to Hal. The drive system could be operated manually, so we were able to pull Discovery away from its decaying orbit around Io. I must say, the farther away I get from Io, the happier I am.
To that point, 2010's Discovery cockpit and Leonov cockpit intact?
How wild is it that after going frame by frame just with a print of the movie, just like holding us still up from the print of the movie and projecting that and drawing from it, they were able to reconstruct the Discovery as accurately as they were, including Hal's brain chambers. And here is a whole section in this book just on the Discovery itself, which these are reconstructions. It's more archaeology.
Yeah.
Excavations of designs.
Model shop supervisor, Mark Stetson.
Records of the Discovery were all destroyed, the Discovery miniature from 2001. And, Mr. Kubrick was concerned about the Discovery appearing in later science fiction films, so he had the models destroyed, all the plans and drawings were destroyed. But our main source of information is a print of 2001 itself.
Peter Hyams and his seasoned crew began principal photography on 2010 in February 1984. With a 71-day shooting schedule, 2010 emerged as one of the largest-scale productions of the year.
Finally, Sid Mead says, "My feelings on the experience of working on 2010. My appreciation of the high levels of expertise required to bring this kind of production to the screen was renewed. The always rewarding experience of making new friends in this exotic industry made the project very enjoyable. And finally, watching the elaborate creation of an alternate reality, I realized with a surreal shock that when it is all over, nothing solid will exist except a few mementos, discarded scraps of set detail, and a vast archive of visual impressions. The real part of it all, of course, will be the vivid memories in the minds of millions who love and appreciate this very durable genre, the science fiction story, the craft which gives the written the dynamic realism of motion pictures."
Whoa.
He's a poet too.
Powerful stuff.
On top of being a great artist.
Yeah.
But let me ask you, what is the thing in your life that most frustrates you that you would like to redesign?
Right now, my
word processor, computer setup. Thoroughly frustrating. I think I'm frustrated mostly with attitudes of people that really don't believe that we can all work together and make things work.
I still have an optimistic view because I think our future is what we're going to arrive at all together, whatever we all do collectively, meaning the whole planet. I like to rehearse for an optimistic future because why not rehearse for the best performance possible? Reality might produce setbacks here and there, but if you don't plan for the optimum outcome, you're almost guaranteeing failure, I think.
An education in industrial design benefited me with a sensitivity to the intricate process ideas must go through to become, quote, real things. A simplification of this process can be stated as a three-phase progression: idea, documentation, and production. Certainly the process is highly interdependent, but without the initial idea, nothing gets produced. There are many more people trained to make things than there are to think things.
Yes, absolutely.
That's still true.
That'll always be true.
I've only done, as a matter of fact, the one pre-release poster for 2010. It has a gouache exercise.
That book is a treasure. Great concept pieces that reveal the much more sophisticated layering of technology, that
the reason that it can live so long,
yeah,
because it's so well thought out, it's so detailed.
Even at 84, you know, sci-fi from that time is not looking so high tech these days, but yeah, it's still very visually impressive and well designed.
You can
it
live
starts from the ground up. I mean, yeah, it really does.
That's how you can live it. That's how we live in it, because we do. We live here. But it's thanks to his designs. And the biggest shocker of all is on the cover itself. What is going on?
That's strange. No.
So, on the cover of the book,
oh,
the faintest image of the Bowman baby inside the monolith while wearing a space helmet with a little light inside.
It is a really strange composition.
Just looking out and smiling, looking at all the other spaceships.
Hello!
And he's scratching his ear too. He's not like, he's sucking his thumb fetal pose. He's like, roger that.
Navigator to pilot, navigator to pilot. IP in flight data hit, sir.
Transmitting from the Leonov. I'm Wes.
And I'm Brad.
Signing out.
Thank you.
Say goodbye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye, Dr. Ford. Goodbye.
What do you mean?